Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Ja, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
What I'm about to play for you is an excerpt from an interview that I held with Greg Nielsen. Greg has been a longtime listener to the podcast. He's been a contributor. He's reached out to me several times, shared multiple sources. It's been awesome getting to know Greg over the years. And here to be able to speak with him one-on-one, to learn more a little bit about the projects that he's got going on, what inspires him, what brought him into the world of understanding our situation and Collapse. It was honestly a real treat. The interview itself was about 40 minutes long. I've put together about 20, 25 minutes for you here. If you want to hear the rest of this interview, and if you'd like to hear the other interviews that we have done as part of our Patreon episodes, please feel free to join us there as we sort of work towards building a community and understanding each other better. Enjoy. Greg, I appreciate you so much taking the time to be on the podcast today. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
For my guests, they may not know, you know, or for the listeners, I should say, you and I have talked frequently, and Kellen as well, way back when you used to reach out and we would have conversations on Patreon and through different channels. And I just want to say thank you for being so engaged. When listeners engage, it's like, that's the motivation that keeps me going, because I know that there's actually people out there listening and it's not just a stat on my podcast host telling me that people are listening. So thank you for being so engaged.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, it's been really interesting to be able to engage, because I listen to other podcasts where, you know, like they run a whole Discord channel and it's all just their staff, right?
No, we're not big enough for that, and hopefully we never will be. And if we get that big, I'm still going to be the one commenting, because I that's the favorite part about it, is working with people. So yeah, great. Well, let's just start out. I want to know a little bit about who Greg is. You know, how did you become Collapse Aware? Let's hear the story.
Yeah. Well, my background is in computer science and computer engineering. And, you know, for many, many years, I was working in what's called embedded systems, which is like the low level computers that are hidden inside stuff that you don't necessarily know are there. And somewhere along the way, and I'm not entirely sure how I got down this path, but I ran into a website called Urban Survival out of Texas, run by a guy named George Ewer, and started reading that before the great financial crash. And really, like, it set me up for seeing that coming and sort of, you know, taking at least a little bit of evasive action and not being like all in on the, you know, on the bubble and stuff.
Nice.
But, you know, he was citing stuff from the oil drum and from various other resources. And I started to realize, like, this stuff made sense, that, you know, perpetual growth wasn't possible. And everything financially was based on us having a, you know, annual growth rate that was unsustainable in the long run. And then, you know, I was also becoming aware of climate change and of peak oil and all of these things. And I'm like, it doesn't even matter what order these things happen. They're all going to bring each other down. And that was when I started looking into moving out of New Jersey, where I was at the time, where I could not consider affording a house, to someplace where I could afford maybe enough land that I could grow some food and things like that, and wound up in, you know, outside of Ithaca, New York, with some land as part of an intentional community. So having, we sometimes describe it as nature with neighbors, but it's a really homesteady oriented community where people are doing a lot of growing, you know, raising, I think we probably got four different flocks of chickens going, and, you know, a couple of people were doing farming on the land and stuff like that. So there's a lot of, you know, a lot of real concentration on, building our own local resilience in the, you know, in the way that you guys had outlined in, you know, building up resilience.
Okay. I got to stop you there and ask some questions, because there's a lot going on there. So when you first kind of became collapse aware, you said that was prior to the financial crash in 2008 is what I'm assuming you're referring to. Yeah. So it's been 20 years or so, more or less. Is that
something? Yeah. I mean, I would say probably around 2006 is when I started. Okay. So a good 20 years that I've been thinking about it.
And what stage of life were you at that point? What was going on in your life?
I mean, you know, I've been working basically for the same company since I left grad school. And I, you know, I had actually been married when I was in grad school, and that wound up falling apart. We just went different directions. And so I was sort of, you know, my friends and I would go into New York City since we were in New Jersey, and sometimes party all night and stuff like that. And at the same time, like, I'm worried about all of this stuff falling down around our ears.
Totally. The cognitive dissonance. Yeah. So, okay. So from that point, you said, okay, I got to take a different direction. Did your career path itself change, or did you continue on the career?
It really didn't, because this was, I mean, you know, it's 2008, whatever. This was pre, you know, everybody working remotely. But my thought process was, I got to get out of here. And if the company will let me work remotely, then I'm going to do that, because, you know, I like my job and I have, you know, a significant role with the company. But I kind of held back on talking to them because I just didn't know if that was going to fly. I mean, the reality was I'm sitting behind a computer, right? So it doesn't matter that much if where the computer is.
Right.
And it turned out it worked great. And I was working remotely from this, you know, this office since I moved into my house in 2008. And so I was all set when the pandemic hit.
You know. Awesome. So have you been in the same home and the same community since 2008?
Yeah. Yeah. This house was built between 2007, 2008. It was one of the first two here. I moved here with my neighbor, who was the big oil drum aficionado. And so, like, we were friends. They were living outside of Albany. I was living in New Jersey. And we decided, let's find a place where we can do this, you know, being ready for collapse together. Mm. So I moved in with a friend and a neighbor to start with. And then we built, you know, more and more. So now we've got, you know, like 20 plus families here in the community. And not everybody's equally collapse aware, but it's another neighbor who actually turned me on to the Breaking Down Collapse podcast.
Oh, so. Okay. Cool. Okay. So this is where things get kind of cool for me, that I haven't talked to someone who's been involved in an intentional community. Have talked to Sean Chamberlain, and he talks about it quite a bit. But from, like, a person who's just decided to go and live in one, I hear all sorts of stories. And oftentimes, or sometimes, they're like horror stories about intentional communities, because there's a million different ways you can set them up, and you're dealing with humans, and humans are just difficult to deal with, right? You have made it 17 years in the same community. Tell me a little bit about how it's set up and how you've made it work for so long.
Yeah. Well, in our, you know, to our advantage, we had some models here locally. There's a community called Eco Village at Ithaca, which I think is maybe hit their 30th anniversary now or something like that.
Wow.
And while it wasn't what I was looking for, because they're much more like suburbia with solar panels.
Okay.
It was, you know, they did help sort of set some models of both what to do and not to do. And we took some training. So we do our decision making with consensus, which a lot of people say, you know, is really difficult. But what we learned is that we need to do, a lot of people would call it modified consensus, because you can't just say, I don't like that. Like, you can't paint your house that color like you might in a homeowners association.
Right.
Our people, like, blocking a consensus decision have to be able to somehow tie that back to the community's vision and mission. You know, saying, like, we can't afford to do this thing because it would make the community a not affordable place to live, that's a reasonable reason to block something. But, you know, I don't want to live near chickens is personal. Like, then you don't have to live here.
Right.
And we learned, you know, a few lessons the hard way in the early days. There was a period of time when we had a policy in place or no killing of animals on the land that we passed essentially because one person said that was a prerequisite for joining the community. The thing is that I had neighbors at the time who were already here who were vegan. They were facilitating the meeting, and they felt like because they were facilitating, they couldn't speak up, but they opposed the policy even though they were vegan.
Oh.
Because they said, we don't think we should be legislating our lifestyle choices for other people. And in the end, we wound up rescinding that policy, and we now allow hunting on the land by members. So, you know, which turns out to be really important when you're trying to do farming and when the deer pressure is so significant. So, we learned some lessons the hard way, but largely it's come down to, when people find out how we operate and what we're about, a lot of people self-select in or out.
Yeah.
You know, if they want to, you know, be able to push people around, they find that they can't really do that here and they don't want to stick around.
Interesting. So you said it was consensus-based, but you said it was modified consensus?
Yeah, so some people will say that the only thing that's consensus is this stuff that goes back to a book by Butler that, you know, some communities use as their thing, which just defines this idea of blocking a decision, but it doesn't go into what are reasons for doing that. And we also do some things in terms of delegating some work to committees and saying, like, not everybody has to be involved in every decision, which draws a little bit more on the sociocracy model that some communities are now favoring, where they talk about circles, circles of influence or circles of responsibility. I think that, you know, over the course of 20, 30, 40 years of doing this, we're starting to learn things that don't work and rule them out, and what's left is working better.
So what does it take to come to a consensus on a decision? I'm just curious what that process kind of looks like.
So we define that difference between major and minor decisions. And largely speaking, like, if anybody feels that a decision is not minor, then it's a major decision. Right. Okay. So if we get to a meeting and somebody's like, hey, can we do this? And everybody's like, sure, let's just make a decision. And then it can be a minor decision. But for major decisions, we expect people to write a written proposal so that there's an opportunity to think about it in advance. We like to have that go through one of our committees, if it's a land use thing, it goes to our land stewardship committee. If it's building something, it goes to our infrastructure committee. You know, if it's financing something, then we've got a finance committee. And so having a committee look it over and say, you haven't really addressed these questions, saves a lot of community time later on. And then we also, you know, with a very rare exception, we try to do things where we bring the proposal to a first meeting just for discussion. So people can get a read on, yeah, this looks like, you know, everybody's generally on board and these clarifying questions really helped solidify like what we should, you know, how we should revise the proposal so it's clearer. And then it'll come back for a next meeting, typically for a decision. And most of the time, you know, most of the time those decisions are pretty straightforward. Once everybody's had a chance to ask and provide input, then the decision-making rarely goes through more than one meeting. You know, it does sometimes when new people show up and they haven't, you know, they haven't had a chance to ask their questions or, when, you know, when the people who are working on the proposal just didn't really hear the feedback the first time or when it's really complicated and it's just taking more meeting time to sort through. One of the things, like a lot of these intentional communities will build a community building, a common house or whatever up front. But for affordability reasons, we decided to postpone that. And of course, that's a huge undertaking. Yeah. And when you try to do that after the fact with the whole community involved, there's a lot of discussion on that. And so we're actually structuring that one as a phased thing where we say, let's just agree generally what we think ought to go into the building. And then we can actually, having a good idea, go get price quotes, right? There's okay. No way a contractor is going to give you a useful answer when you don't even know how many rooms the building has.
Right.
And so we can't think about financing until we've got a quote. And so we just sort of worked out how we needed to stack those decisions and asked the community to sort of agree to go to the next step.
So what if, you know, you say you've got 20 families there. If two of them are like vehemently opposed to something, how do you decide? Is it a majority? Is it, does it have to be unanimous?
Yeah, it's really not an issue that's come up very often. Usually if there's a few families who have a concern about something, then a big portion of the community shares those concerns, maybe just not as openly.
Okay.
And, you know, if it comes down to one person or two families or something who really have concerns about it, our process is structured so that people who don't want to go forward with it as it is have to take a role in helping restructure it so that it works for them.
Okay.
And that way, you know, they're involved in the process of trying to, you know, trying to make it work for them without immediately saying like somebody doesn't like it, so it's not going to happen.
Does everyone have equal representation, or is it based on tenure or family size? Or
no, it's equal representation. We do it on a per household basis. Turns out that's become a little bit tricky because along the way, one of the things that I did was I built a rental house, because since we're building each house as people show up, people want to be here mm-hmm. while their house is being built.
Yeah.
And because I don't have multiple votes to share in the legal structure of things, I can't give one to my tenants who are also long-term community members.
Okay.
So we're actually looking to how we might be able to restructure that to be able to give every household a vote, but still only one vote per household.
Right.
And we, you know, I say vote, but realistically, when it comes to the consensus decision making, it's, are we okay with this? Or are we not okay with this? And if we're not okay with this, how do we fix it? And it doesn't, you know, like one person saying, I'm still not comfortable with this for the following reasons is a good reason to stop and talk about it and figure out how we can resolve that.
Awesome. Yeah. Sounds incredible. And the fact that you say that you haven't had too much of an issue with, you know, running into people who have really opposing views by the end of the process. And you've been doing this for 17 years. That's pretty incredible numbers to consider. Okay, so one last question, I think. I mean, there's so many that I could ask on the intentional community side of things. But what, how does it work from a financial standpoint? People are in charge, I'm assuming, of building their own homes and the financial aspects there. When it comes to communal projects, how are those funded? Is there like a fee to be there, or what does that look like?
So we have a fee that's, you know, functions similar to a homeowners association fee that covers sort of taxes on the common land, and it covers keeping our snowplow operational, and it covers, you know, getting fill material to repair the road, and you know, the lawyers' fees that we have to deal with, because New York has some really, really crazy laws around this stuff. And so that's, you know, and we just share that equally per leasehold. So each, you know, each home here has an equal share of that. It's a little complicated because the people who were here in the early days are responsible, because of the New York laws, for all of the houses that haven't yet been built. So that they're carrying a little bit more, but as each new home gets built, it gets shared more and more equally.
Okay.
And then we have, you know, we have a variety of different ways of structuring projects. So, for example, the farmers have their farms, and, you know, they pay the costs for, you know, for their tractors and for their seed and for their whatever. But they also, you know, get to do what they want to do with the, you know, with the produce, which usually winds up being, you know, offering it at a discount or even sometimes free to the community members, and then taking the surplus for the, you know, for their farms. But you know, then we have projects which are, you know, something that a single person wants to do, and they just pay for it. And then in between, we've got things that happen at a sort of multifamily scale, but aren't the whole community. And so, you know, we might have 8 families that are all working together on a large chicken composting project, and they figure out the materials for the, you know, for the chicken coop, and they figure out the, you know, how they're going to distribute the compost that comes out of it and those kinds of things. And, you know, so just whatever scale people want to propose to do these things, that's what they set out when they say, you know, we want to set aside a little piece of land to do this thing.
How much land is there?
So 120 acres total. Plus,
yeah.
Yeah. And the vision says that we're going to take maybe a third of that for sort of human activity, and a third of that for agricultural stuff, and then leave a third for natural, you know, things, which might include walking trails and whatnot. But so we've been doing some reforestation on the land. One of the big projects this spring, I planted 300 trees to try to, you know, fill in some of that stuff that didn't come through in government grants.
Okay. So are people who are building there, are they purchasing a plot of land within the space?
Yeah. So all of the homes are clustered, and this was part of getting the approval from the town, which has, you know, it's a rural town outside of Ithaca that wants to sort of preserve its rural agricultural character. And so by putting all the homes kind of further away and having farm fields up by the main road, it meant that it would still look farm-like to passersby. And it also means that our infrastructure is cheaper because, you know, we have like 2 large septic systems that serve the entire community. And so, you know, we still only have to pump those out a few times a year instead of every single homeowner having separate septic system.
Awesome.
And stuff like that. So, yeah, it's the individual lots are actually almost postage stamp sized. because of the way the homes are clustered. But then we have a fair bit of, you know, land like out behind our houses where we can do various projects. So I've got an orchard area back there, things like that.
Really cool, man. That's awesome. Well, I have a million other questions that I don't, you know, I'm curious about, but I don't know if it's right time right now to ask them, but maybe I'll pick your brain later. Cause it's just such an intriguing and cool idea. Do you feel like it's sustainable on a large scale to do things the way that you're doing them? All right, there you have it. The first 25 minutes or so of my episode with Greg Nelson. Again, please feel free to join us on Patreon to hear the rest. There's another 15 minutes or so of that interview. Greg had some more great insights, and there are other interviews there for you to enjoy as well. Thanks so much. Have a great rest of your day. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.